The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit G. Suggs Insurance. That's GSUGGSinsurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated November 16, 2020, which is the day that I am reading it. It is edged, as usual, on the front cover in the bright red. The center of the cover is in a pale gray, with Time in caps superimposed in white at the top. In the middle is what looks like a torn American flag. One sees about half of its length with some white and red stripes, not all of them, just 2, 4, 6, 8, 9, with the field of stars. But the field of stars is not on the square. There's a diagonal, and attached to one end that is intact is what looks like the earpiece of a mask. So one end of the flag is torn off, and so is its ear holder, and the other side is being viewed on the cover of Time magazine. This is an illustration by Time. The caption below the torn flag mask states American reality. It is not the Super Bowl. Nobody is going to hoist a trophy on election night, by Mary Beth Kuznick, sole election official of Armstrong County, Pennsylvania. In a pre-election interview with the New York Times on counting votes in the hours after the polls close, November 3rd. Today, we take this fight for black lives from the streets of Ferguson to the halls of Congress. We will get justice. Quoted by Cori Bush, who is set to be the first black woman to represent Missouri in Congress, November 3rd. Bush defeated incumbent William Lacey Clay, Jr. in an August Democratic primary. 65.2 million are the number of mail-in ballots received as of November 3rd. In total, more than 101 million people voted early in the 2020 general election, equivalent to 73% of the total turnout in 2016. I am voting for the first time in my life for the President of the United States, and it's for someone I truly trust, me. That by Kanye West, musician and independent 2020 candidate. On November 3, across 12 states, West received about 60,000 votes. Our fellow citizens are not our enemies. From Mitch McConnell, Senate Majority Leader, November 3, declaring victory over challenger Amy McGrath to win a seventh term. Our Sisterhood is Resilient, by Ilhan Omar, Minnesota Congresswoman, November 3rd. All four progressive Democrats known as the Squad were projected to win re-election. 22, the number of presidential elections in which Ruth Graham Ray of Jacksonville, Florida, voted. Ray celebrated her 108th birthday by casting an early ballot October 31. $14 billion, the approximate total spending for the 2020 election, a new record, according to estimates from the nonpartisan Center for Responsive Politics, adjusted for inflation. The 2016 race cost $7 billion. Our next article is called Long Division, Why America's Rifts Are Only Deepening, by Molly Ball. There's a two-page photo here of a whole bunch of people. The caption reads, "The president's supporters in Grand Rapids, Michigan, ignored the chill at the final rally of his 2020 campaign." The photograph is by Peter Van Ochtmile for Time. Lots of people here wearing parkas, some with hats, caps, some with heavier caps, like ski caps, in various colors. One says MAGA Babe, that's in white with pink embroidery. One says Make America Great Again, that's in blue with white embroidery. Some have the hoods up on their hoodies or parkas. Some have scarves on. There must be about three dozen people in this photo, and I am counting one, two masks with a possible third, except she's wearing it on her chin. The car horns blared as Joe Biden took the stage just before 1 a.m., not to proclaim victory, but to urge his supporters not to lose hope, no matter what President Donald Trump might say. "We believe we're on track to win this election," the former vice president told the crowd in Wilmington, Delaware, November 4. "It ain't over until every vote is counted. Keep the faith, guys." As the new day dawned and dragged on, it increasingly looked as though Biden was right. Having flipped Michigan, Arizona, and Wisconsin, Biden appeared to be inching toward victory. Pennsylvania, Georgia, Nevada, and North Carolina remained too close to call as of the evening of November 4. Independent forecasters believed Biden was likely to eke out the requisite 270 electoral votes when all the votes were counted over the president's noisy objections. Even with the White House nearing their grasp, Biden supporters could be forgiven if they found it hard to keep the faith. The 2020 election did not go according to plan for the Democrats. It was a far cry from the sweeping repudiation of Trump the polls had forecast and liberals had craved. After all the outrage and activism, a projected $14 billion spent and millions more votes this time than last, Trump's term is ending the way it began, with an election once again teetering on a knife's edge, and a nation entrenched in stalemate, torn between two realities, two cultural tribes, two sets of facts. Even if he has lost, a president who trampled the rule of law for 4 years was on pace to collect millions more votes this time. And though they braced for a bloodbath, the congressional Republicans who enabled him instead notched gains across the board. The GOP appeared poised to retain the majority in the Senate and cut into the Democratic House majority, defying polls and fundraising deficits. Republicans held on to states such as Florida, South Carolina, Ohio, and Iowa that Democrats had hoped to flip. They cut into Democrats' margins with non-white voters, made gains with Latinos in South Florida and the Rio Grande Valley, and racked up huge turnout among non-college-educated white people, while halting what many conservatives feared was an inexorable slide in the suburbs. Amid record turnout, Biden seemed sure to win the popular vote, possibly with an outright majority, a resounding statement by any standard, but many Democrats expected more. They believed that voters had soured on Trump and his party, that his mishandling of the pandemic and divisive style had alienated a wide swath of voters, that a new political era was about to be born, and Trumpism banished to history's dustbin. Instead, they awoke to a different reality. Democrats always argued, if more people voted, we would win, says GOP strategist Brad Todd, co-author of The Great Revolt, Inside the Populist Coalition, Reshaping American Politics. Well, guess what? Everybody voted, and it did not help the Democrats. There's a multiracial, working-class ethos that is animating the new Republican coalition. As the votes were tallied into the following day, the candidates' positions fell along predictable lines. The challenger encouraged the core exercise of democracy to continue, while the president tried to stop it. Biden's campaign urged patience. Trump voiced unfounded suspicions about fraud and cast unwarranted doubt on still incoming returns. Despite widespread fears of chaos, the vote was mostly peaceful and devoid of major irregularities. The president's baseless declaration of victory was a sign that the test he's posed to American institutions is not over yet. Biden's campaign was predicated on a return to the pre-Trump political order, a normal that may always have been a figment of the collective imagination. If he emerges as the winner, his achievement, toppling an incumbent who manipulated the levers of government to try to gain an advantage and made voter suppression a core campaign strategy, should not be discounted. But even if he becomes the next president, it seems clear he will be governing Trump's America, a nation unpersuaded by kumbaya calls for unity and compassion, determined instead to burrow ever deeper into its hermetic bubbles. Win or lose, Trump's engineered a lasting tectonic shift in the American political landscape, fomenting a level of anger, resentment, and suspicion that will not be easy for his successor to surmount. Whoever takes the oath of office January 20 will be tested by a historic set of challenges. The COVID-19 pandemic has just entered its worst phase yet, rampaging across the country virtually unchecked. The economic fallout from the virus continues to worsen without new federal aid. Trump has given few hints of what his next months in office may hold, but few expect them to be smooth. An urgent set of policy problems, from climate change to health care to the nation's crumbling infrastructure, may run into the wall of divided government. America's democratic institutions will continue to teeter. If, in fact, Biden wins, it's still the case that an openly bigoted, aspiring authoritarian not only won the presidency, but captured the complete loyalty of one of two major political parties. And, but for a once-in-a-century pandemic, he might have been reelected, says Ian Bassin, co-founder of Protect Democracy, a nonpartisan legal group. If that does not tell you that something's completely rotten in the foundations of our democracy, I don't know what would. The story of American politics in the 21st century has been one of escalating polarization and gridlock, a nihilistic feedback loop that's made the country all but impossible to lead. For years, a chaos-ridden nation has waited to deliver its verdict on Trump's unorthodox presidency. But this is 2020, the year when up was down and real was fake, the year of the plague, the year of the unexpected. Of course it would not be that easy. Both sides hoped for a knockout blow, a landslide, that would forever settle the question of which version of America is the true one. Instead, our identity crisis continues. The campaign unfolded over a year so convulsive that the third presidential impeachment in history now seems a distant memory. COVID-19 upended Americans' lives and drained their bank accounts. Millions of people from all walks of life took to the streets to protest police violence. The West Coast's sky was blotted by fire for weeks, while the East was battered by a record hurricane season. And yet, against this backdrop of chaos, there was an odd political stasis. Trump's standing in polls remained about where it had been when Biden first entered the race, a sign, Democrats believed, that Trump had little chance of persuading an electorate that had long since rejected him. Not that he particularly tried. Strategists of both parties believed the campaign was winnable for the incumbent if he had embraced a more traditional strategy and style. something his entire presidency has shown him to be uninterested in doing. Discarding the advice of the political professionals, Trump insisted on rerunning the 2016 election, down to the leaked emails and anti-establishment rhetoric. He made little alteration to his bull in a china shop attitude, even though the hellscape he raged against was now one that unfolded on his watch. COVID certainly did not help, but this election was about the president's performance over the last 4 years, not just the last 9 months, says Brendan Buck, a former top advisor to the GOP ex-House Speaker Paul Ryan. It was 4 years of bumbling his way through every issue, alienating everyone who did not agree with him, and never being able to use the tools he had for any particular good. As Trump careened from one outrage to another, Biden limited his campaign to theatrically cautious appearances, masked speeches to small, distanced groups, drive-in rallies where attendees sat in their cars. The longtime Paul, known for his garrulousness and gaffes, stuck unerringly to the script. Many lines in his final TV ads were identical to what he said when he launched his campaign a year and a half before. Unusually for a general election candidate, Biden actually saw his standing with the public improve over the course of the campaign. Only about 10% of the ads aired by Biden's campaign and allies were attacks on Trump, according to the Wesleyan Media Project. His campaign believed his themes of unity, compassion, and expertise were an implicit rebuke to the incumbent. The message has been incredibly consistent, an implicit contrast between Trump's character flaws and their consequences for real people, says Democratic strategist Jesse Ferguson, a veteran of Hillary Clinton's 2016 campaign. Trump is self-absorbed and chaotic. Biden's the opposite, in it for others, stable, the antidote to everything Trump represents. But Democrats now wonder if Biden, like Clinton before him, put too much emphasis on character and not enough on kitchen table issues, and whether his decision not to campaign more in person was a missed opportunity. Biden was buoyed by a vast grassroots movement. The Trump era has seen a frenzy of political action with thousands of newly motivated activists leading local political groups. Middle-class women gathered their Facebook friends to drink wine and make canvassing phone calls. Disaffected Republicans waged a multi-million-dollar campaign to mobilize their peers. A weak fundraiser, that's W-E-A-K, fundraiser who ended the primary, essentially broke Biden shattered general election fundraising records. His campaign hauled in $952 million, dwarfing the incumbent by more than $300 million, as liberals showered donations on him and the party's congressional candidates. But Trump had his own army of enthusiastic supporters. His massive rallies held at cavernous airport hangars and sports arenas with no social distancing and limited mask wearing were not just aimed at flattering Trump's ego or creating images of enthusiastic throngs for local and national media. Republican National Committee, RNC, teams perched outside each event, registering new voters and creating a database of supporters. People sometimes poo-poo the rallies and say there's really no campaign structural benefit to them, says Brian Ballard, a Republican lobbyist with close ties to Trump. But they allowed the campaign to utilize the crowds that not only go, but the crowds that registered to go. And sometimes that number is five times the amount of folks that actually show up. Trump's campaign also kept up its field organizing program through the summer. while Biden's team hung back out of safety concerns. The joint field program between the RNC and the Trump campaign boasted 2.6 million volunteers, according to figures provided by the RNC. They made more than 182 million voter contacts, more than five times what they did in 2016, and added nearly 174,000 new GOP voters to the rolls. Early voter registration figures in Florida, North Carolina, and other states showed that Republicans had essentially neutralized what had been a Democratic advantage by mobilizing new voters, says John Podesta, who ran Clinton's failed 2016 presidential bid. Democrats underestimated the Trump tribe's breadth to their detriment. I think you miss some of the Trump quotient in polls because these folks come out of the woodwork, and they're out of the woods and waters of South Carolina, says former GOP Representative Mark Sanford, a Trump critic whose Charleston area district Republicans took back November 3. Despite putting more than $100 million behind Senate candidate Jamie Harrison, Democrats fell short of defeating Senator Lindsey Graham by double digits. These Trump rallies and Trump parades and all those kinds of things, they don't strike me as the type that would be answering a polling call, Sanford says. Having made the decision to forego traditional field organizing, Biden's campaign manager, Jen O'Malley Dillon, instead turned the Biden campaign into what may be the largest digital organizing machine in American political history. Jen O'Malley Dillon took a risk in investing as much in digital acquisition as she did, says Patrick Stevenson, chief mobilization officer at Democratic National Committee. You are putting down $1 million in April that you're expecting to show back up as $5 million in August. By September, the digital operation was printing money. Digital organizers recruited more than 200,000 volunteers and deployed them on hundreds of millions of text messages and phone calls. But the result raises questions about whether this virtual juggernaut could really substitute for old-fashioned face-to-face campaigning. What comes next is anybody's guess. There are 2.5 months until the next inauguration. A lame duck president with the world's biggest platform, an even larger ego, and millions of supporters who internalized his rhetoric about election rigging could stir a lot of trouble on his way out of town. So much, including the odds of violence erupting, depends on Trump's rhetoric in the days and weeks to come. Viewpoint: America's Faltering Global Role by Ian Bremmer, who is a Time columnist and president of the Eurasia Group. It is only fitting that the most divisive U.S. election in recent memory would end in a most divisive election eve finish, one that will have consequences for America's standing in the world. As of this writing, the ballot count continues to be underway. President Donald Trump wasted little time before declaring victory, setting himself up to later claim that his opponents were trying to steal the election. For Trump, a president who has shown remarkably little concern for the long-term health and legitimacy of U.S. democracy, refusing to concede makes all the sense in the world. Beyond the powers of the presidency itself, Trump's current and future command of the Republican Party is at stake, as is his ability to use the powers of the presidency to shield himself from financial and legal troubles. The chances of Trump's gracefully conceding an election loss were always vanishingly slim. While there remains a good chance that Joe Biden emerges victorious once all the ballots have been counted, a Biden loss will be devastating for Democratic supporters, many of whom could also feel that the election was rigged against them. Regardless of the way the final presidential tally shakes out, one thing's increasingly clear. In 2020, there's no advanced industrial democracy more politically divided than the U.S. is today. Trump's overperformance in the election relative to poll expectations solidifies that fact and makes clear the divisions in the U.S. electorate are more structural and ingrained than many political pundits had hoped leading into November. There's a photo here. It's in color. It looks like a small cafe or perhaps a bar or tavern, coffee shop. There are a couple of tables that appear to be laminated. Oh, excuse me, they have brown laminate-looking tablecloths on them with black chairs surrounding them. There's a big screen TV perched up in the corner of the room, below which is an open door into perhaps an office. There appears to be a desk with a lot of papers and other things stacked on it. The ceiling is ridged as if it may be one of those old metal ceilings, and there's a fan suspended from it. Two men are seated, one at each of the tables. Both have their chins in one of their hands, or each has his chin in one of his hands. There are a couple of photos on the wall of one is a city scene with a streetcar in front of a building, and one is a boat on a lake. But on this TV screen, there's a big American flag with an individual standing by it. One does not know who it is. It's a rather blurry view from here. But the caption reads, "Tea drinkers in Istanbul watch one of President Trump's press conferences." So I guess the blurry TV signal shows President Trump. Returning to the article, the fact that neither side looks like it will quickly concede the election does not mean the U.S. is on the verge of becoming an authoritarian state. Its democratic institutions, though admittedly weakened in recent years, still remain firmly entrenched, with the overall level of U.S. wealth continuing to provide some cushion. But the U.S. is increasingly moving away from being a true, functional, representative democracy in the mold of a Canada or Germany, where the direct will of the people is reflected in government policy and their elected leaders, and is widely accepted by the losing side, and is moving more toward being a hybrid political system, such as we now see in Hungary and Turkey. It is not quite that bad just yet, but it's trending worryingly in that direction. Regardless of who ends up being sworn in as U.S. president, that means more dysfunctional U.S. politics at home and a weaker U.S. international presence when compared with that of the past 50 years. On the domestic front, expect arguments over political processes and policy issues like free trade and immigration to continue raging and to divide the country. Social media will also continue to drive the polarization of Americans of all political stripes. That dysfunction at home will, in turn, make it difficult for the U.S. to lead by example on vital issues like climate change and tech regulation, or to face China with a united front on tough issues like trade and security. That is true, even if Biden does ultimately secure the presidency, as he will likely face a Republican Senate and be limited in how much political capital he can expend on foreign policy. The world was looking for a statement election from the U.S. It got one. Expect the next 4 years of U.S. politics, at home and abroad, to look more like the past four rather than the past 50. Time off, opener, music, country music's Unlikely Boom by Andrew R. Chow. When the coronavirus hit the U.S., Gabby Barrett's breakout year was thrown into peril. The 20-year-old country singer-songwriter had just found her footing in Nashville with the steady rise of her fiery breakup single, I Hope. She planned to build on the momentum with a debut album and a global tour with country idol Brad Paisley. Instead, the tour was canceled, forcing Barrett into the longest break of her life. "It was strange not being on the road," she says. "It's pretty much all that I know." it looked as if country music itself were facing hard times. The scaling back of the physical spaces where the genre thrives, concert halls and bars, radio and concert tours, emphasized its vulnerability in the virtual realm. Having long prided itself on resisting the technological changes that have transformed the music industry, country risked falling even further behind hip-hop and pop, which dominate apps like TikTok and streaming services that now represent 80% of total music industry revenue. Barrett, for her part, settled into home life, soon to learn she'd be expecting her first child. Then something unexpected happened. I Hope exploded in popularity, topping the three major Billboard country charts and becoming the first debut single by a woman to top Billboard's country streaming songs chart. Meanwhile, the genre broke out at large, hitting a record number of streams for 3 weeks in a row, while pop, hip-hop, and Latin all sank below their baseline averages. iHeartRadio's country stations, too, rose 7.4% from winter to spring. Country's popularity has only grown during the pandemic. While the overall industry has risen only 2.6% on streaming services compared with its baseline pre-COVID numbers, country music has soared 15.8%. According to MRC data, Nielsen Music. Country music concerts have been among the first to spring back across the U.S. at varying levels of social distancing, while rising stars like Luke Combs, Morgan Wallen, and Barrett are racking up huge streaming numbers and crossing over into mainstream success. Country music has thrived, says Pohlman, iHeartRadio's chief programming officer. Experts suggest the reasons for this are both emotional and technological, as some listeners seek comfort in the soothing, nostalgic qualities of the genre, while others who previously disdained streaming platforms finally caved and subscribed. But while these factors might be temporary, they're also building a new foundation for country's digital era resurgence. Its fans' increasing willingness to engage on digital platforms, combined with its artists' explorations beyond Nashville conventions of songwriting and sound, could move the genre back toward the center of mainstream consciousness. Because all these writers and singer-songwriters are stuck at home, I fully expect Nashville to start pumping out some of its best work in years, says Johnny Chang, director of operations at Cox Media Group Houston, which includes country stations KKBQ and KTHT. It is not a new phenomenon for country music to rise and fall with the seasons. A representative for Nielsen says they expect country music listenership to increase during the warmer half of the year, when the genre serves as the soundtrack for cookouts, road trips, and tailgates. Summer also is when touring giants like Garth Brooks and Jason Aldean hit the road, raking in millions in revenue from new and old fans alike. While the pandemic erased many of those events, people still turn to country in droves, perhaps precisely because it represented normality in turbulent times. Country music is authentic, relatable, and gives you comfort, says Brittany Schaefer, Spotify's head of artist and label marketing in Nashville. You want to be in a place that feels like home at a time when the world feels uncertain. However, the places and times where listeners sought out country music changed. In Houston, Chang's station's ratings during the previously crucial morning commute block fell sharply. Conversely, streaming services have seen a sharp uptick, with listeners tuning in from their home workstations. On Spotify, country's been the second fastest-growing genre of music globally since February, behind electronic, making most of its gains in the U.S. and Canada. partially what we're seeing is the natural progression of country fans starting to catch up with these other formats. And the country market had a lot of catching up to do, says Melinda Newman, Billboard's executive editor of the West Coast and Nashville. In other genre, back catalogs are indexing higher than usual as fans seek familiar melodies. But in the country world, a new generation of stream-first artists are racking up impressive statistics, satiating younger fans' appetites for something new, while also offering wistful, nostalgic sounds to country diehards. Combs has led the charge. His album, What You See Is What You Get, has been a streaming juggernaut, with at least five of its songs passing 50 million Spotify streams. In the midst of this boom, some fear that many lower-profile members of the country industry are being left behind, because country music relies so heavily on touring and live sessions. Thousands of workers are out of jobs with bleak prospects to return in the coming months. Layoffs or furloughs have been reported across Nashville, including at the Country Music Hall of Fame and Creative Artists Agency. The only people making a ton of money right now are labels and songwriters, Chang says. But the studio musicians, the touring musicians, the crew, even the managers, they are in trouble. Lauren Jenkins, a Texas-born singer-songwriter, feared the worst when her career was sent into free fall this spring. Her East Nashville community had been torn apart by a devastating tornado. She was dropped from her label, Big Machine. She watched as every concert she'd booked this year, including a tour of the UK and Europe, evaporated. To keep afloat, Jenkins turned to live stream concerts with virtual tip jars and found that a small but devoted audience would gather to watch her several times a week and send her money. She has since performed more than 100 concerts from her living room, but she does not have to pay for travel or other overhead expenses. She has been able to pay her rent and for studio time for her next album. Jenkins' unlikely success gives hope to the idea that country music could regain its centrality in mainstream culture after the streaming revolution pushed it to the sidelines, and she is not surprised that it is flourishing in a crowded digital marketplace. It's the types of songs you can play socially distanced around a campfire, she says. You do not need anything except for a guitar, a voice, and a story. And that article was slightly abridged. Time Off Books. This is a review, The Case for Crowding In, by Ibn Shapiro. Rents are the most explicit metric of the premium people are willing to pay to enjoy the heady pleasure of living in the world's great cities. And currently, they're down sharply in New York and San Francisco. London and Paris recently imposed new rounds of lockdowns, so perhaps it is not the ideal moment to publish Metropolis, an ode to cities and cosmopolitan life as humankind's greatest invention, according to its subtitle. In a hastily added few paragraphs in the introduction, the author, British historian Ben Wilson, acknowledges that the COVID-19 pandemic could turn the tide against cities, once again encouraging people to flee metropolises. But he also adds, cities are resilient, adaptable entities, capable of standing up to all kinds of disasters. In fact, considering that many urban innovations are responses to disasters, perhaps it is just the right moment for such a book. Innumerable historical examples show that counting cities out is a sucker's game. For one, Venice and other European centers lost at least 30% of their population to the plague in the Middle Ages. Beyond the enduring seduction and economic and environmental benefit of cities, Metropolis has the added virtue of Wilson as an erudite creative guide to the history of civilization through its great urban areas. He is a voracious, eclectic reader and an artful deployer of quotations from Plato to NWA. The Epic of Gilgamesh is read through an urban planning prism. The opening credits of The Sopranos is what urban geographers call a transect, a slice taken from the city center to periphery that reveals a range of social and physical habitats, Wilson writes. He has a reporter's eye for freshness, highlighting relatively recent archaeological discoveries of the grand cities of the Harappan civilization, circa 2600 BC in the Indus Valley. These cities were so clean that Wilson speculates they may have been the historical basis for the Garden of Eden story. Few things symbolize collective civic endeavor more than the seriousness with which a city deals with its daily tonnage of human waste, he writes. In the Indus cities, flush toilets were standard in the 3rd millennium BC, more prevalent than they are today in that region of Pakistan. His reporting takes readers to remote corners of China, where 700 mountains were literally moved, raised, and the rubble tipped into valleys to create an artificial plateau on which a shimmering new skyscraper city is being built. He broadens the book's focus beyond the usual Western suspects, noting that all but one of the world's 20 largest cities in the Middle Ages were Muslim or in the Chinese Empire. Wilson is a sensualist, chronicling the sexual and gastronomical draw of densely packed people. He loves descriptive lists, citing author and co-founder of the satirical magazine Punch, Henry Mayhew's account of the most popular street foods of the 1850s, fried fish, hot eels, pickled whelks, sheep's trotters, ham sandwiches, pea soup, hot green peas, penny pies, plum duff, and on and on. He provides an excellent account of the erotic draw of cities from ancient Babylon to the present day. He's also enamored of the energy and entrepreneurship of street life in emerging megacities such as Lagos. That city's messiness, he writes, is not a sign of poverty and shame, but a dynamic sign of a developing city. At this current scary moment, when crowded cities can seem dangerous, even life-threatening, look at history to see what emerges from the other side. It's instructive in imagining what can come next. After the Black Death, rents fell and wages rose. Pre-pandemic, the world's great cities were increasingly derided as playgrounds for the rich. It is heartening to reimagine a New York, a London, a Hong Kong, where teachers, artists, mechanics, inventors, and police officers could live, jointly creating the next triumphant iteration of civilization's greatest invention. Again, jointly creating the next triumphant iteration of civilization's greatest invention. The review by Eben Shapiro is of Metropolis by Ben Wilson, A History of the City, Humankind's Greatest Invention. Time off food. Baking brought me comfort as a child. Now it's getting me through the quarantine, by Beth Nguyen. When quarantine times began, everyone around me started making sourdough. I baked cakes. Nothing against bread. I just crave the precision of a layer cake, the fiddly work, as it is called on the Great British Baking Show, a comfort series that I rewatched while making comfort cakes, tarts, and galettes. Bread is a staple, but cake brings joy. For me, it has always been that way. My family arrived in the U.S. as refugees from Vietnam at the end of the war in 1975. We were resettled in Michigan, in a conservative town where I grew up not knowing what to do with all the racism we experienced. I was a shy child who had nightmares and fears. My whole family was anxious, but no one talked about trauma. We did not know the concept of self-care, but surely that is why we loved to gather around the TV set with ice cream and potato chips. We loved little treats, candy, packs of gum, the rare Sara Lee pound cake, and Entenmann's coffee cake. When I was 10, my mom enrolled me in a senior citizens cake decorating class as an after-school activity. There, in a community center kitchen, I learned how to shape buttercream into roses and leaves on little squares of wax paper. We did this over and over, flower after flower, lines of leaves until the frosting ran out. It was satisfying, doable, magic. I would listen to the ladies gossiping and laughing and feel included in their warmth, gaining secret knowledge about the world. And so I became the baker in my family. Though my childhood was filled with the tension of not understanding identity and of feeling like an outsider, I knew two things for sure. Everyone feels a little better when presented with cake, and everything feels a little better when there is cake. Now, all these years later, I have returned to the Midwest, Wisconsin, the other side of Lake Michigan, and I'm teaching my own kids how to bake. I thought their childhoods would be so much safer and more stable than mine, but I did not know we'd be in a pandemic, living in a state that currently has one of the highest numbers of COVID-19 cases in the country. Like so many people in America, we are stressed out. We have not gone to restaurants, have not gone anywhere, but at least we can bake. Through these long months since March, I've been trying new recipes, chinoise and Gioconda and Victoria sponges, choux pastry, rough paste pastry, short crust pastry, churros and apple fritters, pies and hand pies, carrot cakes, chocolate cakes, strawberry cakes, pound cakes, bundt cakes, almond cakes. On our 100th day of sheltering in place, I made a Boston cream pie. I started leaving cookies, cakes, fritters on my neighbors' porches and finding treats on my porch, too. Late at night, after work and school and kids' bedtimes, I made caramel and cream pâtissière. Not every item's turned out, but every effort has made me feel more capable. Recently, I taught my kids how to make those buttercream flowers. I had not done this in more than 20 years, but it all returned to me. The little squares of wax paper, the yellow counters in that community center kitchen. My kids are 9 and 11. As I watch them try to form the petals of a rose, you have to move quickly, confidently, keep practicing. I wondered if I had looked that way at their age, determined to make a sugar flower bloom. I'm a person who still carries fear all the time, but my children think I'm fearless because I can cook and bake. I deep-fry donuts without hesitation. I deal with boiling water, broilers, gas flames. I remembered how to make a buttercream rose in a matter of seconds. To my kids, I know how to do so much. In times of waiting and worry, it feels useful to gather ingredients and turn them into something that might bring sweetness to someone's day. Baking is so much more than following directions. It's about understanding process. It's about trust. Whether I'm baking with my kids or baking alone, I feel a sense of peace I rarely have any other time. Whatever the result, I know I'll be a little more ready for whatever comes next. Beth Nguyen is author of the novels Short Girls and Pioneer Girl. 8 Questions of Maya Rudolph, the comic actor, on revisiting adolescence, transmitting warmth, and her triumphant return to Saturday Night Live. This article is by Judy Berman. question. You live in Los Angeles, but you've been flying back and forth to New York City every week to play Senator Kamala Harris on SNL during a pandemic, on top of a raft of other projects. Plus, you have 4 school-age kids at home. How are you coping? Answer. Every day feels different. It's a roller coaster of anxiety and emotion and frustration and sometimes motivation. I've been checking in with friends who keep me up to date and feeling more hopeful because it is easy to get down in the dumps. That being said, aside from finding 4 different quiet spaces for children to have school, I find the time spent with family comforting. I have enjoyed reassessing everything in terms of school and work and home and family and friends. It's a good way to weed out the bull SH-blank-T. Question. Harris is often framed as hard to read because she does not lead with ideology. Was it tough to find a way into her character? Answer. I don't see her that way. I fell in love with her. There's a conversational, familiar tone in the way she speaks. That element of her that's so approachable allowed us to lean into a style of telling it like it is, of someone who feels like they are your friend or your auntie. Question. You've been popping up in plenty of other roles on SNL this season, too. Is that a side effect of being inside the show's COVID bubble? Answer. I think it is that, combined with everyone in that building knows how much I love the show and how much I love to play there. All the time I've put into the show has allowed any writer there to know my voice, so it is easy to plug in. Question. Sarah Cooper's recent Netflix special, Everything's Fine, is the first release from Animal Pictures, the production company you co-founded with your longtime friend Natasha Lyonne. How does that partnership work? Answer. We are first and foremost people who love each other, and we work at completely different speeds, which is a great thing. I came up with the idea for the name Animal because she's an animal when it comes to work. She embraces and loves every second of it. I like to take my time. Question. You seem to have reached a point in your career where you can pick and choose roles tailored to who you are as a performer. Like your stint as a chatty deity on The Good Place, how does that feel? Answer. It is a nice feeling. It took me a while to get to that place, and it is an exciting place because creatively it is more inspired. I feel supported, and I'm more comfortable when I'm supported. Question. Do you have a sense of what creators are looking for when they seek you out? Answer. You are asking me a question I ask other people. I always have a hard time seeing how I am seen in the world. Question. Would it be fair to say that warmth is a trait most of your characters share? Answer. If that is being transmitted, that's a good thing, because it's what I naturally gravitate toward. I do well with goofy, and I work best when I think something's funny. It is one thing I can rely on when I am feeling self-doubt. Question. One of your most beloved characters is Big Mouth's Connie the Hormone Monstress, an animated creature who guides kids through puberty. She is a mentor, but also the embodiment of raw adolescent id. What appeals to you about Connie? Answer. Her funniest stuff to me is when she is in that adolescent place of true feeling. It is the part where I go, we are all human. We are all messy, and it is fun to collectively laugh at how we all go there. She is very in touch with herself, very raw and honest. It is fun to play a character that is that free. Frontline heroes, India now has the world's second highest COVID-19 case tally, with more than 8 million confirmed among the country's 1.3 billion people. About 2/3 of whom live in rural areas lacking health facilities. Female community health workers like Sunita Rani are working to fill the void, often for little pay or without protective gear. We are warriors who were sent to war without any weapons, Rani tells Time. There's a photo here of quite a number of women. Some are seated, some are standing. There are trees, green trees in the background. Most are wearing masks, as we might wear as consumers in grocery stores or other public areas. One has a yellow scarf wrapped around her head and also covering half of her face, which would also be protective. All are wearing pink smocks. One is carrying quite a large bag, like a tote bag. It may be her handbag, but it may also contain some of the gear that she is using as she works in healthcare. Here's another quote or two from the election reports page. Texas ain't blue yet. John Cornyn and more. Democrats' dreams of tipping Texas were squashed as Republican Senator Cornyn, C-O-R-N-Y-N, was projected to hold his seat in all but one still uncalled race in U.S. House. Districts held by Republicans seem to have stayed that way. The GOP also looks to have kept control of Texas House and thus of redistricting. GOP, women win U.S. House, Maria Elvira Salazar, Nancy Mace, and more. Far-right races, NC House, Madison Cawthorn at 25, will be the youngest representative in modern congressional history. He's also one of several far-right House candidates who were projected to win November 3rd, including Lauren Boebert of Colorado and Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia, both of whom have at times expressed interest in baseless QAnon conspiracy theories. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired, and we've run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine's available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. Again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.